I would like to close this meeting at this time. I think all of us have, gotten what we've come to hear. Really, I think gotten what we've come to see this morning. I know that all the time, we talk about love, and it's very difficult to love people. I find particularly church people, in my experience, particularly people in the Christian community. And it's a real bonus somehow when you find people whom you love and can love as human beings. And Bob and Nancy Pierman have meant this in my life. I've been sitting here crying, little boy, because if a month ago, I remember one morning praying in my own home in Austin, and I was weeping, and which I have only learned to do since I've become a Christian. And I was sitting there weeping because I felt like somehow my life was useless. And I had that feeling you have, about kind of a hopeless feeling about the future. I didn't know what I was going to do and how I was going to do it. And I wanted some sort of sign that God is real, in the midst of this kind of an experience. And as I sat here this morning, and I saw Bob and Nancy Pierman come up that pathway and meet Howard Butt that morning. And what's happened in their lives is a fantastic witness to me that Jesus Christ is real, that he's in the life-changing business, and that he's in the business of doing the impossible by changing us into the people he wants us to be. Now, I know not long ago I was asked to go to Detroit, Michigan, and speak to a group, and in this group, they had the meeting started late, as this one did this morning. It was my fault I wasn't here. But the meeting started late, and they told me I had, 30 minutes and to prepare. And I was very new. This was several years ago, and I was rather new at trying to speak before a lot of people. And so I had my 30-minute talk down pat because I was going to do just what they said. I was going to tell them the story of my life with Jesus Christ. And so I got up there, and I was thinking over what I was going to say. I was terrified. And I remember sitting there, and the preacher got up in front of me, and he was a fine man, and he had had three great messages, and he gave them all. and I remember they had told me that when the time is up, at the end of this meeting, because we've got a carefully scheduled program today, somebody would come up and tap you on the shoulder. Well, if that won't terrify you, I didn't know when he was coming. And so this man finally finished, and I looked at my watch, and I had 8 minutes. And I had to summarize the first 28 years of my life, in 6 minutes, so I could tell them about Christ the last two. And I thought, I've got to spend more than that for Christ. And so the man gave me the key right out of his message. He was talking out of the 6th chapter of Mark. And he summarized my life out of the Scriptures. He said, and Jesus said to them, come apart by yourselves. And that's exactly what I did. I don't know how many of y'all were here last night, but Fred Smith told me it doesn't take very long to spend the night in Tyler, Texas, and I know what he means now. some of this joy is hysteria that we're living in. I want to talk to you a few minutes, and I really do feel like it's almost an impertinent to speak at this time, but you have at these kinds of meetings witnesses and speakers, and I'd rather witness to you about what God means to me, because I wouldn't have any hope to be alive if it weren't for the fact that I feel like God accepts me as I am. But I've been asked to speak to you a little bit, and what I'd like you to do is to pick up where they left off and to talk about what does a person do, to get from a commitment to Jesus Christ back into the program of the church. Now, this may, boy, is a big veil that falls over your face. Is he going to talk about this? But if we don't talk about this, if we don't learn how we can become involved with this stream of Christianity that broke out, like a great, flood of water from the empty tomb and started rolling down the generations of which we're a part right here in this room. If we don't learn how to do this, man, we're through. Because as sick as we are, and we're the church, it's the only thing God's given us. And I've always been bugged by church people, by church organizations. As Bob said, man, I didn't want to be identified with the goodies. And I sat on vestries right here at Christ Church. And I remember going home, and I had to have two drinks of scotch, and, you know, just to get home from a Christian meeting. You know, but I was so proud. I didn't know anything much about Christianity when I first started getting in the church, that I married into the Episcopal Church in college. And when I first started getting involved, I thought, man, there's got to be something divine about this deal, because the way it's being run, you know, you'd go out of business if God weren't in it. And as I began to look around, and I sat in on meetings, and they'd say, okay, we're going to have a slogan this year, you know, 6,000 by 66. And I'd go, you know, I just cringe. And but I'd vote yes. Who can be against 6,066? Who can be against anything, you see, that we're doing? And so we sat there, and I looked around. A lot of times I just want to say, crud, or whatever the Christian word that's translated into that. I translated it once just to get it to you. I would want to just say, oh, no, God. But I'd look around, and here were all these leaders in your community, some of you sitting here today, I imagine, who look like you're taking this seriously. And I thought, man, these guys are doing a lot better than you are. You know, how can you say all this? It just doesn't make sense. And I had a lot of questions going on down inside me, and I wasn't hearing any answers, and I was just hoping to God that somebody would come up with my question. And they never did, and I was afraid to ask it for several reasons. One, I thought the church's approach was sick, but I didn't have a better deal. You know, and I'd learned in business, you better keep your mouth shut unless you have a better deal. Two, I didn't want to admit how little I knew, because everybody else seemed to know so much. And they intimidated me, and a lot of you in this evangelical community intimidate each other because some of the intimidees have come to me and said that you flash these Bible verses, you know, just kind of like ants rub antennae, you know, and you don't find any identification, you don't touch until you say a Bible verse. And this just scares people, you know, who have five kids and can't memorize very well. And the third reason was I didn't want to make a big mistake at my age. Now, so I sat there and voted yes on all the things that just sounded terrible to me. They didn't make sense. They weren't where I lived. And then I was glad to get out. And we fought to get off that vestry in a you know, Christian sort of way. But, you know, this business about making a big mistake, I was at a meeting this last March, and there's a fellow named Bob Raines at this meeting who's written a book called New Life in the Church. And if you want to have your church come alive to Jesus Christ, read this book. It's very good. And he was speaking that night, and he said, talking about making a big mistake, and he was saying, oh man, I remember this. And I want to tell this story because there was a train that went from Chicago to Dallas, one of these overnight trains. And, well, some of you have taken that train. And it goes through, among other places, Oklahoma City, Norman, Purcell, Oklahoma. Now, Purcell, Oklahoma, you've got to look fast to see it when you go through. But it's a county seat, and they were having a guardianship oil and gas lease sale there that morning, the next morning after this story took place. And this man had come clear from Chicago to buy that lease, and his company had said, get it or it's the end for you. So he was a very sound sleeper, and they were going through Purcell at 4:30 in the morning. And so he came to the porter and he said, now listen, porter. He gave him $10. And he said, I'm in this room at down here. And he said, I've got to get off that train, but I'm a terribly difficult person when you wake me. And he said, so I don't care what you have to do to get my clothes on and get me off this train, but I want you to do it. And here's $10. The porter said, yes, sir. So the next morning at about 6:30, the porter was sitting in, waiting for the people to come to breakfast in the dining car. And all of a sudden, here came this guy. He hadn't shaved. He was in his pajamas. He came in and he looked at that guy and he called him everything in the book. And he finally, just in frustration, just reached out and shook him. And then he turned around and stalked out. And the conductor was standing there and he said, man, I've never seen anybody so mad. And the porter said, "You should have seen that man I put off in Purcell, Oklahoma." But I couldn't make a mistake like this and live through it in the church. But about 12 years ago, I began to find a kind of hope. It was as if Bob said, "You get checked out a new set of eyes." And I began to see that my job was not to, you know, to play to these guys on the vestry as my audience. My job was to find out what Jesus Christ wanted us to do. And just in a little small voice, you know, to say it, whether it meant anything or not. And to ask the real questions I had in my life. And oh my goodness, it's been a revolution ever since in my life. Because as I began to do this, I began to come alive to people like you. I began to want people to find some of the hope I was finding, even though I was on the ropes lots of the time. But suddenly my life had meaning, and it never had meaning before. And I realized that this was the name of the game. And so as I did this, I still was bugged by the problem of the church, which some of you may be able to identify with. And I remember last January, I was asked to speak on a program in back east where there were going to be between 500 and 700 ministers from 23 denominations. And the other people on this program were all Dr. Somebody. And they said to me, and I was very, just in a humble sort of way, proud, until they told me, "Miller," they called me and said, "We know you don't know anything, but we think maybe you might give us an honest opinion about what laymen think, and that'll do something for you." But, because I thought they were including me with all these guys. And I got ready to prepare, and I thought, boy, now's my chance. They wanted to know how laymen, something to the effect of how laymen get involved, you know, in the whole business of God's people in the church. And I thought, now I had to face it. And I kept putting it off. I don't know if any of you have ever written a talk, but I kept putting it off and putting it off. And finally it came the day before I was to leave on this plane, and I had to sit down and write this talk. Well, I sat down for an hour in a blue funk, just staring at the paper. I don't know if you've ever done this. It's a horrible experience, especially that late. And I realized, I said, why can't I get involved in this? Because this was the church's program they'd given me. You see, and here I was again. I didn't want to do it. I thought, I ought to want to do this. And I thought, what can I do? And then I sat there and I thought, wait a minute now, why? What are you thinking about? Because if I can figure this out, I'll figure out why it is I'm not involved in the church's program more deeply anyway. And I thought, now, come on, Miller, bring up. What are your real thoughts right now? You know what they were? Number one, I was to follow one of the most brilliant men in the church today, in my opinion. He's a witty fellow. He's a professor. He's written a tremendous book recently for laymen. With layman in the title, "Help, I'm a Layman." This guy has an earthiness about him and a love of Jesus Christ, and he's brilliant. And I had to follow him speaking on the same subject back to back, and there wasn't even a hymn between us. And I couldn't call him. He was in Union Seminary on taking a sabbatical, and I couldn't, we're doing work on the layman, and I couldn't call him to find out what he was going to say. And you know what I was thinking? I was thinking, Miller, you may not look too good. Here I was to tell these people about the unselfish love of Jesus Christ. And I couldn't even get involved in preparing because my problem was you might not look too good. All right, and I quickly said, what else are you thinking about? You know, I tried to think of something more Christian. And I did. I thought, how can you capture these men's imagination for Jesus Christ? And then something said to me very quietly, or is it for yourself? And I never solved it. I never knew for sure. But I realized in that moment that this is the crux of the matter. This is why I can't respond to the church's program. Because I've got some problems that are much more threatening, much more personally involving me in my relationship with the church than their program. And I've got to face these first. And as I sat there, I realized, my gosh, if this is true, then maybe the church, maybe we in the church are dealing with some of the wrong issues. Maybe we've got some of the wrong problems. And as I began to think about this, I got very excited because I thought, we have assumed that we solved these problems and now we're going to go out and do something and we don't have the motivation because we know we're being phony about something else. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to sit here and figure out what is, how do you know what the real problem is in your community, in your place? How does one figure out this? And this was a very exciting experience for me. And I asked God to help me figure this out. And then I got to thinking, how do we solve problems anyway? And I'd like to talk to you about this just a second, about how we solve problems in the business world any place. Because we don't have religious problems and other problems. Any problem that keeps a man from God is a religious problem. And this is what Christ came, it didn't say on your program, I came to bring in abundant religion. Jesus Christ said, I came to bring you life. Simply life. With God in the center of it. So as I sat there, let me check you out on this. Let me give you a problem here. And you solve it. And let's just see how it goes. I'm going to, a very simple problem in arithmetic. I'm going to pretend that this is a blackboard, and I hope you'll pretend too. I'm going to put a 9 up here. And below it, I'm going to put an 8. And I'm going to draw a line. Now, I would like for somebody in this audience who is a Baptist to give me the first answer that pops into your head out loud. 17? 17. All right, now, I would like for some person who is a Presbyterian to think, if he can, of another answer to this problem. 1. All right. I would like for someone who is an Episcopalian to think of possibly a third answer to this problem. 72. All right, now, I've given you the same information exactly, and the Episcopalians are 7,100% different than the Baptists in their interpretation of this problem. I think this is what we've done in denominations. God's given us the same information, but we get totally different answers. Why? Well, I think when you go to solve a problem, the number one thing you have to do is to take a mindset about what the problem is. You have to decide ahead of time what the problem is. I didn't tell you there was a plus or a minus or a time sign. Because of your own experience, when that thing flashed up before you, you decided unconsciously what kind of a problem was. And once you decided what kind of a problem it was, there was only one answer and you'd defend it to the death. And you were right. Because see, your mindset. And I think this is the way we separate ourselves from each other. In the church's program even, have you sat on a committee? And you know, wherever two or three are gathered together to figure out what the problem is, you got 4 hours on your hands. You can't even figure out what the problem is because we have different ideas of what it means to be a Christian. And let me give you, let's talk about this just a minute. Because if this is true, then when you go in to figure out what the problem is, you have unconsciously decided ahead of time what it means to be a Christian, and this is the criterion for all of your decisions in the church. You see, you decide ahead of time, a Christian means to do this. Therefore, I don't like this program because it doesn't fit my idea. You don't say that. You just say, I don't like the program. Or I say that. But I'd like to discuss with you in these last few minutes that I have some things I think are inadequate about what it means to be a person who lives for Jesus Christ. And if you can decide that today, what it really means to you, not just to be saved, but to live for Jesus Christ, it may change your whole life. A lot of you have been Christians for 5, 6, 10, 20 years and are miserable with your relationship with other Christians. And if you could just solve this one thing today, it'd be a good day. So think with me just a minute. Let me give you some inadequate views, and Dr. Finley Edge has been a real help to me in this. Some inadequate views of what I think it means to be a Christian, of what I think people think it means. And you see if this fits you. In the first place, in this part of the country, there's a big idea that to be a Christian means what we don't do. You see, I mean, if you commit adultery and I don't, I'm better than you. I'm a better Christian. If you commit adultery and drink, and I only commit adultery, I'm still better than you. Isn't that right? See, if you commit adultery and drink and smoke, and I commit adultery and drink but don't smoke, I'm a little ahead of you. You see? All right, well, how does this, if you carry this to its logical conclusion under God, what is Christian perfection? It means lying in bed alone, inert. Inert.
And that affects the way you see, you decide your programs. You know, somebody brings up something and you immediately screen this through, you edit this and say, uh-oh, people will think we're doing such and such. And we're not supposed to do that, so down with the program. Okay, let me give you another view. And I do think there are things we shouldn't do. I'd like to hesitate to add. I know I led Elijah, a fellow came back this year to a single adults conference, and I've spoken to the one last year. And he was from Dallas, and he was very excited when the question time came, and he said, Keith, I want to ask you something. He said, I was arguing with my friend who was here last year, and you did say if you can't quit adultery, you ought to cut down, didn't you? So I want you to know that there are some things I think you should not do. But if you make that, if you make this the criterion for what it means to be a Christian, the world will hate you, and rightly so. You know, a lot of people say, well, I'm being crucified. You know, and this was happened at a meeting at Lady Elijah Ministers meeting, and one minister said, well, they don't like me very well, but said, you remember our Lord was crucified? And another minister spoke up from across the room, and he said, yeah, he said, but there were three guys crucified that day, and two of them deserved it. You know, so your odds are not too good just because you're being crucified. All right. The second thing is that being a good Christian means things we do in the church. Now, this means that a man who goes at 11 o'clock is a good Christian. You know, you say, well, yeah, he's a good Christian. I see him at church 11 o'clock every Sunday. Now, he's a little better Christian if he goes at night, on Sunday night. And if he goes on Wednesday night, we're all praying for those people who only go on Sunday night. You see, and then what's the next step in this hierarchy of goodness? Well, maybe I'll become a Sunday school teacher. Or maybe a vestryman. Or maybe even a minister. And you know what the ministers worry about in seminary? I wonder if I ought to go to the mission field. You see, because there's this hierarchy we build up, and a guy says, I can't make a commitment because, you know, I might have to go to the mission field. Well, Jesus Christ, you know, didn't say, you know, get on the ladder and climb, man, in that sense. You know, I think this is such a horrible thing because the poor boy who works on Wednesday night can't make the squad. You see what we've done? If this is what it means to be a good Christian, then, you know, you stumble over the bodies of your children to get out and be a good Christian at the meeting. You know, and I think a lot of us have done this and the world hates us for it. And I think rightly so. Now, I do approve of going to church, but I don't think we can earn this righteousness, and that's what this whole doctrine of things we do is what it means to be a Christian. And I think it's wrong. I think it's inadequate. Now, the third one is, intellectually, if I can say the doctrine correctly, and this will get home to some of you, you may not like this, but I only am here one day and I feel free. Doctrinally, this is what it means to be a good Christian, to say, I accept Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior and understand it and really mean it. Or to say the Apostles' Creed or the Westminster Confession or whatever your church says, and to really mean it. Or some of you to discuss Karl Barth and Paul Tillich and really understand the dialogue between these men. Or whatever your criterion is intellectually, that if you have the doctrine, you're a good Christian. Baloney. In a loving sort of way. I think this is the most dangerous one of all. It's the one Jesus Christ fought the most. The Pharisees had the doctrine. And there was something wrong with him. Now, I read a book recently by Dr. Paul Stern, a psychiatrist at Harvard. And he said that in psychiatry, they're finding out that the biggest resistance to healing, the most difficult thing to get through in a therapy relationship, is what they call intellectualization. And he defines it this way, and I'd like to read it. Intellectualization is the tendency to avoid the emotional impact and deeper personal involvement with the meanings of problems by transforming them into purely intellectual statements, which do not seem to involve the deeper layers of personality. Now remember, this is what keeps people from being healed. It's the most difficult resistance to overcome, is the fact that people can glibly turn a phrase. Now that means that a lot of us who can say an awful lot about the Bible, and a lot of us who can say an awful lot about Christianity, somehow don't smell very good in the eyes of the world. And we don't know why. We may be using this whole deal to keep from really getting involved with our wives or with our husbands or facing the fact that we have tremendous hostility. But we have correct doctrine and our security lies in that. And I think this is why the world may hate some of us. I do think we must have good doctrine, But if you make that the end of your religious search, I think it's sick. And the last thing I'd like to mention, and there are many more, but see if you fit into any of these. And the last one is social issues. A lot of us get the idea that if we really love Christ, we will go and become involved with people in the Negro situation, and in the political arena, and other areas that we must go and witness. And this is what it means to be a good Christian. And as with all these other things, there's a great deal of truth in this. But do you realize what's happened? If a man gets the idea that I must do this to be a good Christian, you know, then he gets on the bus and he goes down to Selma, Alabama, and he's going to witness for Jesus Christ. And those people better get out of his way if they don't agree, because he's got to do this to be a good Christian. And his good Christianity hangs in the balance. And if it turns out that when he gets down there, he's come 2,000 miles and it's all over, he's going to stay. Because he went down there to make a witness. And then there are other people who go because they feel like God wants them to go. It's a very different reason. And when they get on the bus and go down there and it's all over, they don't put up any signs. They just get back on the bus and go home and thank God that it's all over. You see, if any of these things become ends, as fine as they are, and the finer they are, the further they keep us from God. What do I think it means to be a Christian? Because, you know, you've got to have something you think it means, because this is your unconscious assumption. Well, I think it's something like this. I think that each of us is born somehow, as Nancy said, with a restlessness. I think when a little baby is born, all it has in the world that makes it communicate with the rest of the world is hunger. Do you realize that? The little baby gets hungry and it screams, and it gets a response from its mother. And it learns that screaming is not a bad deal. Sometimes I'll scream when I'm not hungry. And some of us are still doing it. You see, this makes it possible for us to have a world to live in, is our hunger. And we satisfy it. And when we get enough food, we've got a hunger. We're still hungry, so it drives us to get other things. And this is the motivator that pushes us along the years. Well, I think God's given us a spiritual hunger. And we keep trying to satisfy it with things, with church activities, some of us, with women, with whiskey, with business success. And we keep looking ahead and saying, when I get there, this awful restlessness won't be there anymore. I think this is the way we're made. Camus said, I think, who is it, that if each one of us is born in a little black box inside, and we spend our lives tapping on the wall, hoping to God somebody will hear us, as Nancy described this morning, hoping maybe a husband will, or a wife, or somebody. I think that God and Jesus Christ has come this horrible gap we have, this loneliness and restlessness. He has somehow put Christ down as a drawbridge from him to us, so that we're no longer alone. And the deep restlessness for a purpose in life is in him, as Jesus Christ puts down this drawbridge. Now this does something to a person when he makes this commitment and accepts this acceptance. Suddenly my security is no longer in this room. My security is no longer in how well I do with you some days. See, and this allows me to be honest with you and who I am, because I can go back in and I'm not alone in the world, because I have a drawbridge out of this world in terms of to a relationship that is very real and close to me. All right, now what this means is that our program, you see, it changes everything. Then this gives me the courage once in a while to do the same thing God did, to put down a drawbridge to you as a person in your life. And when I do this, this is what Christ means by laying down his life. This is the greatest thing a man can do. Well, we're a psychological generation, which they were not. What does it mean to lay down your life today? It means to be vulnerable. I can love you enough to chance your rejection. So I began to creep out of myself, and I put down this drawbridge to you. And suddenly you're no longer alone, because I'm in that black box with you, and you're with me. And when you come across that drawbridge, you have to walk on my life. I take the risk, because God has taken the risk for me. And when you get into my life and close, then I point over my shoulder and I show you where that drawbridge is. And suddenly you have a relationship with God and you're putting down drawbridges. And this is what the church is, in my opinion. And then you can check the program. You see, is it unlocking people? Is the program making people less lonely? Is it tying them into God and each other and helping us to love each other because we're vulnerable and free to take a chance? And then I think that there's another thing that it means to be a Christian, another chasm, because, see, this chasm between you and me is almost as deep, sometimes even in a marriage, almost as deep as the chasm between a man and God, and much harder sometimes to get across. Then each one of us, I think, or I don't know about you, but all of this is witnessing. It's only me. I know that when I was a young man, I wanted very much. I figured I used to wake up in the morning and dream that there was a fine man inside me someplace and that maybe someday he'd come out. But I was afraid. It was way just dim glimpses back in my life because I was afraid to try to be that man for fear I'd fail. I knew I couldn't be a good man. I had awful thoughts. I had terrific ambition, which I still have, all these things. But I couldn't understand them, and I knew I didn't want to be a phony. But I got these glimpses, and they haunted me. And I think what God does is puts down a drawbridge between the man right here who's living with you and his true self that he was created to be in the image of God. You see, and then, as Nancy and Bob said, then I can accept myself. I don't have to be a hero because I know that God has somehow put down a drawbridge and allowed me to see that I'm a little boy. And I'm a little boy who's found hope. You see, and I don't know anything about telling you how to be good, but if any of you lack hope and lack meaning, if any of you have a terrific fear, you know, that your life is going by, and somehow you've missed the name of the game, this is what I think it means to be a Christian. To let Christ put down this drawbridge so that you can become a part of his body and a part of his church in the world.